Thank you so much for sharing these practices with me. I love to do these silent practices of meditation, the walking meditation. And I think I particularly enjoy eating in silence. And since we couldn't quite do a whole formal meal, I thought the sare would be a way to get a little taste of that attention that silence brings to whatever is in the moment. And one of the participants yesterday came up to me afterwards and she said, "It felt like communion." And I thought, what a beautiful image of that these ordinary practices of our everyday life, every day we eat and drink, if we could bring that spirit of communion to it, at least some of the time. The title of my workshop, I realized in non-Zen circles, it might not quite have the same resonance. Chop wood, carry water has been, a phrase to denote dailiness, daily life. That in Zen particularly, there is so much attention to the simple steps of daily life. And at the Zen Center, we practice, you might wonder what these formal practices have to do with dailiness, but we practice on a very simple level. For instance, eating in silence so that we can really bring our attention to eating. Walking with a meditative quality so we can really be present each step. There's an intention to feel the earth under each step you take, to feel that meeting of you and the earth each time you take a step, which was not exactly as easy to do in the midst of our busy lives. Another practice called Niten Soji, I guess? Niten, I always got it. Niten Soji is the chores that one does around the Zen Center, the students do. It's a short period, but it has to be a simple chore because, again, we're trying to keep our focus. So it's usually sweeping or raking or scrubbing or cleaning the toilets. That's a favorite one. Or mopping the floor. And to bring this meditation, this sense of inner awareness, as well as the outer awareness to what you're doing in the moment. When I was coming to this conference, I thought, gee, it might be good to look up where chop wood and carry water came from, because it is, as I said, just such a, in Zen circles, they just throw it out there as dailiness. And it actually comes from a Chinese Zen master, and the whole of the poem is marvelous action, miraculous power, chopping wood, carrying water. I said, oh, there's the missing component. There's joy. There's real joy in this dailiness. And that was really a beautiful revelation. I think when we're in retreat, when we do these practices, joy comes, peace comes. True love, as Roshi calls it, comes. True love is when you can loosen your identification with the small self and realize your true Buddha nature, and that all things and all people, because of the retreat, as I said, we sit facing each other. We don't make eye contact, but we're there together 7 days in that zendo. We walk together. We eat together. Nobody leaves the dining room till the last person has eaten the last drop and washed his or her last bowl. We never You know, we can't come in from walking till everyone has done their business and everyone's back in line. There's a real sense of community and realization that when our egos are not presented, there is this total feeling of oneness, of us being, of human beings on planet Earth together. It's a really beautiful and joyous feeling. What I wanted to talk a little bit about is my 30-year struggle to integrate these practices in daily life, because I found it was rather easy to go up to the mountain. I loved meditation. I loved the sense of oneness when I didn't need to talk to anybody and find out who liked me and who didn't like me. And it was easy to feel the unity. But when I came down the mountain, it was much, much harder to sense not only that unity, but the joy in daily life. One sense of, I think we all know that Zen is very, very much about the moment and mindfulness and attention. And in fact, when I was thinking about the title to this workshop, it was Chop Wood, Carry Water, Attention in Everyday Life. But I thought it was rather amusing that Llewellyn mentioned that attention has a militaristic tone. I don't know if you were there when he talked about Mrs. Tweedy's song was rather militaristic, and she stood to attention when she met her teacher. And so that, for me, there is a certain hardness. So I came to the word presence, and I love that word. It's a softer word for me, and it also has that delightful quality of a present within presence. And so that's the word I've been working for in bringing presence into my everyday life, in the same sense, of course, as attention. Presence is your total being, which does include my small self. You can't quite get rid of your small self, but it brings in the whole quality of Buddha nature, small self, earth, where we are, whatever is happening in the moment. And that has been my practice, more or less successfully, in trying to integrate spiritual practice, which I thought of as spiritual practice, which only took place up on the mountain with the teacher. How, and when I came down the mountain, I could not hold on to that sense of unity, to the sense of peace, to the sense of my own worthiness as one who contains, as we all do, the essence of life, Buddha nature. We don't use the word God very much in Buddhism, though my Roshi, having come to the United States 42 years ago, has often brings in that word and then challenges you on whether you are fixated on some limited and personal idea of oneness or the divine or greatness or Buddha nature. So he'll throw that word around a lot. I came down from the mountain, and I think I rejected life on many levels, even in the midst of having children and trying to live as a partner in householder life. There was always a sense that this was not the real thing. And if only these children would behave, and only if I had enough support, and if only then I could be a really spiritual being. It sure takes a long time for human beings to learn. It took three children, the third a very unexpected surprise when I had asked I'd asked my Roshi after my youngest son was almost 5 years old. I said, my youngest son is 5, Roshi. I'm ready to ordain. I really want to commit to spiritual practice, and I want to help the Sangha. And he said, okay. And a month before my ordination ceremony, I became unexpectedly pregnant with my third son. And I got the message from the universe that maybe spiritual life wasn't ordination up on the mountain, that maybe you're mothering, you're being present for everyday life, was your spiritual practice. And I did finally get it. I always say, Rinzai Zen students are very stubborn, very hard-headed. Took 3 children, and not only children, but boys. Not a girl among them, 3 boys. And then a 100-pound male dog arrived on my doorstep with an 8-month-old baby and a new house, and he proceeded to chew holes in my new house, in the walls of my new house. I was getting some very important lessons. But I did get it, that this life is it. So why do we practice if this life is it? I always, it's a good question. If we can find oneness in our daily life, why do we go to retreat? Why do we go to the mountain? And I heard, I think it was Rajneesh, yes, I had an interesting saying, realization or enlightenment is a gift. You don't achieve it by any efforts. So why do we try? Why do we practice? And he said it was an accident, when this happens. So why do we practice? So we can become accident prone, was his answer. And I thought that was a good answer, to align ourselves. And so in my daily life, I had to modify these practices. I don't usually get a chance to sit even. Well, now I do, now that my children are older, but when they were young, I never got a chance to sit for maybe 30 minutes a day, which is the minimum requirement. Usually in Zen practice, they ask you to sit in the morning and the evening for at least 30 minutes. And I couldn't even do that. And when my children were really young and nursing, I couldn't go up the mountain, and I couldn't see my Roshi. And I just started improvising. Whenever I could, I would take 2 minutes. I figured, well, yes, 30 minutes is good, but 2 minutes is better than nothing. And I also knew that I couldn't go into a closet, so I put an altar right by my kitchen, by my phone in the kitchen, where everybody, sort of the center, the hub, and I would just light a candle and a stick of incense, and I would just meditate until I was interrupted, which was usually after 5 minutes, a child or a dog or the phone. But I thought that if I could be responsive, that was really important. And yet I needed to touch that place where I was not a mother or a dog sitter or a house caretaker. And that was really important. And I put an altar in my car. I was telling Sophia's mother, keep forgetting her name, that was the best meditation I would get when my children were really young, because whenever we would drive out, they would fall asleep in the car. And we pulled into the driveway, I would just sit. They're asleep, just sit up straight, close my or do my focus, and I usually got 20 minutes. That was just such a luxury. They could, it seemed like clockwork. After 20 minutes, they would wake up, okay, let's go into the house. And that was how I did find a way to integrate these formal monastic practices. These are monastic practices. They are not designed for householder life. But they do, they in the training and in the attention, it is a practice. I'm a dancer, a choreographer. I also was a musician. And I knew I couldn't do triple pirouettes unless I practiced. That there was a component of intention, even though I also came to realize that realization or the uncovering of my Buddha nature was not going to happen by my own efforts or by my Roshi's efforts. It was a gift. So it's this play between the intention and effort that one puts into spiritual practice and also the surrender and release to wait for that gift. I recently came, I'll backtrack a little bit to householder life. I recently came across a very nice sentence that really spoke to me from a modern American poet, Anne Truitt. And I think it goes, the decision that is in alignment with one's inner development is when you decide to put down the burden and take up a natural responsibility. And that's what I came to realize, that I saw life as a burden. You know, that I was carrying on my shoulders and on my back, and I didn't have enough help. I didn't have enough support. And when I decided to put it down as a burden and take it up as, and I'd like to insert the word natural, joyous responsibility, that is when I first started to practice and it felt like to me. It only took, well, this was like two or three years ago. So it only took 27 years. I was very blessed with my relationship with my Roshi, because I certainly, without that heart connection, I probably wouldn't have made it through the burden part, through the 27 years of feeling that life is a burden, and that Zen, and he always pointed me back to life. And I was explaining to people that the way he works in Rinzai Zen is koan practice. And for some people, he gives the traditional koans. There's a, you can read them in the Mumon Kan or the Hekigan Roku. These are traditional koans that have been passed down from Zen masters from China to Japan and now to America. But in 30 years, he never has given me a traditional koan. He's always used life as my koan. I mean, simple things like, how do you realize your true nature when you're sewing? And I always thought, oh, how does he know I hate to sew? Wow, what intuition. And having to work on that koan, having to bring my loving presence to the sewing so that I could go back to him with my answer to the koan, transformed my relationship going. And every step of the way in my life has been koan practice has been an instrument for transformation. And I think when I was pregnant with my son, I always sat session as in day and retreat. I always sat session with my children in utero. I take credit of the fact that their teachers always tell me that they're the most focused students that they've ever had. they don't do any meditation practice at all, but I attribute it to practice in utero. And when I was pregnant with Damien, my third child, Roshi gave me a koan. How do you realize the world as your child? And that is the koan that I will keep close to my heart. hard rest of my life. Because as a mother, that practice, and I did it three times, mothering practice was the most opening transformational practice that I had.
It wasn't the mountain.
And I was very grateful that I already married and had a career before I met Roshi.
I was very young, but I was a
professional dancer.
I met my husband in high school.
So we've been together all the time.
And so I had a husband and a career when I met Roshi.
Otherwise, I'm sure I would have been up on that mountain now, taking the crowbar to get me off.
So I was very grateful that I had to do household practice.
And art practice.
She helped me a lot with my
dance career.
He said,
one of my colleagues was,
wasn't a common,
he said, but I had to dance,
not only for
the people in the front row,
but
for
the ants
in the back of the auditorium.
So that's another practice I keep close to my heart.
That sense of joyous responsibility,
this is life.
Roshi always manifested.
He was
very.
He's 97 now.
So his energy is a little diminished.
But
he was always so funny.
He was always cracking up.
Just this really joyous energy that came through him.
I'm not sure that is his personality.
I don't know him as a personality, as well as a closer associate.
From what I hear,
I hear not his personality,
but his Buddha nature came through
as this joy.
And
I think I'll just end with him at home, which I really love.
And then we can open it up to questions.
And the poem, he doesn't write very much.
Most of his feels that
printed word is not.
While he's alive,
his talk and teaching will not go out in print.
That it has to be an immediate transmission.
But the Lama Foundation invited him back in 1973
to do a week-long retreat,
and they taped his talks
and printed them up.
I think with his permission,
but I'm not so sure.
I think there was permission later.
But it starts
in the preface to the book is his poem
that he composed on his 67th birthday.
Of course.
Now, when we met Roshi,
he was in his early 60s, and we were in our 20s. When
Roshi
always says, "You have to come practice with me because I am an old man.
I'm going
to
die."
And when you're 22 and or 23 and he's 65, you believed it. You thought, "Oh my gosh, we better go up to do Sesshin because he's an old man." So he composed this on his 67th birthday. As a butterfly lost in flowers, as a child fondling his mother's breast, as the bird settling on the tree, 67 years of this world, I have played with God. And I have great, great love and admiration for my teacher. I really honor him. So, questions about this practice? People had a lot of questions yesterday, but I didn't talk first, so they remembered. Anything about the
About Kuan Yin.
Uh-huh.
Several years ago when I was visiting in Kansas City, I went to the major art museum there. I happened to walk into the Asian section, and in a darkened part, there was a 9-foot wooden painted statue of Kuan Yin from the 9th century. And beside Kuan Yin were 20 smaller Buddha statues on either side. Mm. And behind this whole display of statues was a wall painting from a monastery with at least 500 Buddhas. And Frank and I stood there, and we couldn't leave the room. And after about 15 minutes, I turned to him, because we kept standing in front of Kuan Yin instead of just walking around the museum like we were doing. And I said, "Do you feel compassion?" And he said to me, "Yes, I keep feeling it right here." And we kept standing there because it was like a beam of energy was coming from the wall or from the 9-foot Kuan Yin statue of compassion. I knew nothing about Kuan Yin at the time. And we stood there for an hour because it was such a strong energy. And then we went downstairs into the museum store and I found out that she was the goddess of compassion. So I didn't know if the statue, if many devotions over the years of people from the 9th century on, the energy was still there in the statue, in the wood, in the stone wall. I didn't know where that energy was coming from in their mind.
Perhaps it was coming from Kuan Yin. The question is, do you want to know a little more about Kuan Yin, or have you done your, have you?
Well, what I've read hasn't.
Well, do you know the title of Kuan Yin? Kuan Yin is she who hears the cries of the world. And we are honoring Kuan Yin on our altar because my Roshi has given me a mandate or a task, or I'm not quite sure what to call it, job, to start a Rinzai Zen Women's Center for Meditation and Practice. And we honor Kuan Yin as the boat will, it's called the Bodhi, she's also the Bodhisattva of compassion, because she took a gender change. Originally, Kuan Yin was Avalokiteshvara, one of Buddhist disciples, who's known for his compassion. And he merged with a Chinese legend of Princess Kuan Yin, who was also known for her great holiness. And so she's probably also the goddess. She has many forms, but in Asia, she is always called upon in times of need. And I said this yesterday, what I appreciated, because we're, as women practicing, Roshi has always said that compassion comes really naturally to women. It's our birthright. And in his teachings, he always said that women got it right away, the sense of being able to surrender to relationship, to feel and to hear what is needed in the moment, and that men were a little denser about that. But women also had difficulty in manifesting that quality in the world, and especially at this time in our history where the male and female energy is really unbalanced. So I think his vision is that women, and Kuan Yin is standing on the dragon. The dragon is a symbol of power. That women can take their power. Not, it's a different power than we know of power, into the world. And he feels like this training, this Rinzai Zen training, is a way to get that, is one way. He knows there are many ways, but that is his hope, that women can come together and practice together and meditate together and bring that power out into the world. So we honor Kuan Yin on our altar. Usually in a Zendo will be Buddha in many forms. Manjushri Buddha is the Buddha of wisdom. He's usually the most commonly. There's a lot of Buddhas, as you saw. And there are different mudras, and there are different how many bumps he has on his head. But the Buddha often represents wisdom, and Kuan Yin, compassion. And she who hears the cries of the world, I love that it wasn't she who goes around and fixes everybody's problems. Because I know that was my concept of compassion, that was my concept as a mother and a woman. I burnt out constantly. I became exhausted, useless to my children, useless to anyone, because I was giving, or running around trying to fix everybody's problem, not trusting their own innate nature. But I understand that it's very important to hear the cries of the world. Very important. I'm glad you had such a lovely experience with her. She's always around. She is so present, especially now.
Mm-hmm. This is still about Kuan Yin. I've heard people say that Kuan Yin is really the feminine of the Buddha, but that's not what you're saying, is it?
No.
But the relationship, what is the relationship?
Well, I guess because she did this, I mean, Avalokiteshvara did this gender change. It's different than like in Hinduism, where you have the Shiva and the Shakti, the equal forces, or the yin and the yang in Chinese. That's not quite their representational. In Rinzai Zen, or the Zen that Roshi teaches, which is called Tathagata Zen, those principles of male and female are never put into form. Because it's so easy to fixate on gender qualities. So Roshi's very careful. In fact, he uses the terms plus and minus. He has several mathematician students, and it does help, that plus and minus does help to get it out of that realm of gender, but you know, some of us have a little trouble with that, the dryness of that imagery. Right, then see, I don't think Roshi understood what minus means in English. You know, there's a he's always said, you know, teaching in America and not having quite learned the language, he says it's always been like shaking hands with gloves on. It's just a little bit so. But he gives a teisho at every, you know, he is so dedicated to bringing these concepts out. 97, he sees each student 4 times a day and gives an hour-long talk every day of retreat. And and we try to limit it to 30 people. And then the last session I was at, 50 people showed up. And I calculated, 50 people, 4 times a day, that's 200, times 7, 1,400 interviews. Yes, 1,400 interviews. And only once did I see him tired. Only once. Any other questions?
But you mentioned that this was a sort of a monastic practice, and I felt that way while we were doing it. How does, if one was in this Zen path, how would you balance the monastic practices against the need for chopping wood, carrying water?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question. Right. So how do you balance?
What good would that do to my everyday life?
Right. So how do you balance, if you were to adapt this or come into this monastic practice, how would you balance that with everyday life? Well, the monks and nuns, of which I am a nun, a lay nun, I always think that's a very funny term. They have to do the jobs. There's a beautiful system in this monastic practice, and you have to be in a position, different leadership positions for like 6 months at a time. So Jikijitsu, that was me. I'm the timekeeper, And I'm responsible for the zendo and the meditation and the walking, and I'm the father, because sometimes it doesn't feel so comfortable sitting in meditation. Sometimes we meet discomfort and problems in our meditation with resistance. And you need a firm father keeping those boundaries. So that's the jikijitsu's role. But the shoji, my friend Laura, was shoji role. She or he is the mother of the zendo. And all the students, if they have any problem, you don't go to Father Jikijitsu, you go to the mother, Shoji. And she gives you back massages if your back hurts, and aspirin if you need it. And it's, oh, and just like a mother hen, I mean, she's, or he's just watching the zendo. Oh, someone's having a really hard time, maybe I better find out. Maybe, you know, they're just mother, unconditional love. So and then there's the one who has to run the whole retreat, the shika, the business person. He has to make sure everybody has a ride to the airport, and the money's been paid, and the food's been ordered, and, you know, when something breaks, and the head administrator. And then, of course, I don't know if you know Dogen's instructions to the cook. It's a very famous Zen text. You know, Zen is very concerned with right here, right now, and food is very important. The Tenzo is supposed to be the most important position, aside from the Roshi, in the monastery, because he, through what he puts into the food, can either create health and well-being or discomfort and sickness, and not just what he or she cooks, but the intention, the energetic intention that is put into the food. So Tenzo is very important. And then there's the Densu, the hospitality person, who's the interface between the outside world and the monastery, and leads the chanting. And as an ordained person, you have to do all those positions at some point. And it is an amazing training for everyday life, to have to do father practice, mother. So I think the monks and nuns do get that. And when Roshi feels that they're ripe enough, he kicks them out. You do not get to stay at the center. You have to be in life. You have to go down the mountain. And sometimes when he's being really feisty, he sends you down the mountain in the middle of retreat and makes you deal with Claremont, California, or Ontario Airport, and then go back up the mountain. His most favorite saying is, at once, now. You know, at once, you have to be in the world, or driving that car, or sweeping the walk, at once, right away. Any other questions? Am I running close to time? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just wondered if you could address for a few minutes the relationship between practice, Zen practice, and the arts.
Yeah.
Especially painting, because I've seen some beautiful paintings and drawings of Zen.
Yeah, the question is the relationship of Zen practice to the arts. And of course, many people only know Zen through the forms, art forms that came through, like the circle, unsu, right? The circle, or just the black and white, or the calligraphy, and then of course into the realm of flower arrangement, ikebana, and of course the famous tea ceremony and the shakuhachi flute, yes. So these were all tools of manifestation for monks and nuns. There's a wonderful saying of a Zen master who was trying to do his circle, and he had a little boy disciple, 13, I think, and the master drew his circle, and the little boy's kind of looking over his shoulder and going, not quite right, not quite right, try again. And he does it again. Oh, really off the mark. Roshi, really off the mark. And he does another. The boy's going like this. Then the boy, I guess, had a call to nature and went outside, and the master goes, and he comes back, oh, yes, there it is. That is the at-once. The manifestation of one's being can come through these art forms as long as the ego is out of the way. And, of course, so much, I know so many of you are old practitioners, and you know that so much of this meditation practice is to disentangle ourselves from identification with that ego. And art really, truly benefits from that disentanglement, because it is expression of the oneness, of the beauty, of the joy of life, and it is often our ego that is putting the brakes on that expression. And I certainly found it true in my dancing. I was with the Margaret Jenkins Dance Company, and my choreographer, Margaret Jenkins, was always very happy when I went away to retreat, because when I came back, she thought I was much freer, not only in my movement, but in my creation. I mean, I tend to be a Virgo type, and not too loose in my, like, for instance, improvisation. I was a musician before I was a dancer, and I could not improvise. You stick me, you know, give me a piece of music and I'll follow it to a T, but I could not improvise. And modern dance has a lot of sense of self-expression, improvisation. And she always saw that when I came back from getting in touch with my deeper self, or the Buddha nature, however you want to think of it, then I was really free to have the expression come through me. And so it's been truly wonderful. And I love performing for the ants in the back of the theater. Any other questions?
What just came to mind was, I heard a lot about, in Buddhism, you talk about walk without walking, mm-hmm. sit without sitting. Can you say, explain that a little more?
Of course, the intention in meditation is to dissolve. And that, I think, is walking without walking, when there is no self directing the walking. There's no self directing what happens on the cushion. The Buddha nature, God, oneness, Allah, comes through, and you are taken.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, where is your Zendo? Where do you practice?
The Roshi has finally limited himself to three centers. He used to go, we had a center in Austria and New York and Puerto Rico, and he used to go all the time. But now he is centered in Los Angeles at Rinzaiji, Mount Baldy Zen Center, which is truly up the mountain, outside of Claremont. It is quite a trip up that mountain. And then the Bodhimanda, which is in Jemez Springs in New Mexico. So he is dividing his time between those three centers. The Women's Center is in Cobb, California, which is Northern California. And it's a small center. It's set up to have retreat for as many as 15 women. When Roshi was setting this up, he used to come and we would do retreat for 15 women. Now we do more like weekend retreats, one day, 2 days, or 3 days. The information for that is in the back of Merrill Hall. I have a flyer that has these are all women retreats.
Can you explain a little more
The center of gravity? I love that term. Roshi doesn't use it very much anymore, but again, it was one of his ways to try to translate some of these Buddhist terms. He kept meeting all these scientists, so some physicists talked to him about this physical and actual place in everyone that is the center of gravity that connects you to this earth. It's about 2 inches below the navel, and I guess he resonated with the concept of the hara, which if you've done any martial arts, they talk about the hara, which is the belly. And so he often would say Buddha, in fact the title of his talks from the Lama Foundation is Buddha is the center of gravity. And he says trees and rocks and chairs have center of gravities. And in his koan practice, he would often ask you, how do you realize your true nature when you see the pine tree? And for me as a dancer, I said, oh, well, let's just merge our center of gravities. that helped me give me a physical, something I could grasp. I mean, I guess it's not that physical, but it's much more physical than some of the abstract ideas that came through Zen. But I love that, I always love that when I teach meditation, because then there's this connection to the earth. I love that connection to the earth that the center, when I put my attention to the center of gravity, gives me. And of course, there are other things going on. You know, the straight spine allows energy to come up and down, in and out. But I love that anchor. Did that help answer?
So that deepens your presence, right?
And it certainly, and it certainly helps for Westerners. You know, we identify our mind with here, you know, in our heads. I mean, it's such a tense place. How many people have neck problems? Or, you know, how your neck gets so tense trying to hold your whole being up there. And it just, even physically, is such a relief to drop your mind into your belly. So I found it a great practice.
During meditation?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. The idea is to put your mind, whatever that means for you, into the hara and to follow the breath. That's the only instructions I ever received. Oh, and koan practice. But as I said, I once said to Roshi, well, do I have to think about my koan? Oh, no, don't think about your koan. You know, he didn't want you thinking. No thinking was very popular with Roshi. Often you'd walk in for your interview and he'd go, no thinking. And he'd ring his little bell, that means out. You know. He could hear your thoughts, you know, before you even got in the door, practically. And I was very lucky to meet Roshi when I was 23, when I was young enough to be trained in a way that I think it's much harder when you're older, but very possible. Any other questions?
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, I found that in a book. Well, one of the instructions for posture, we do get instructions for posture, and one is that the chin is pulled back. Not in a tense way, because you don't. But it is pulled back slightly, and the explanation that I got from a Zen master that was writing about it is that the old brain, our pre-thinking, pre-rational, logical brain, is our limbic brain, which is underneath. It's the old brain, right at the top of the spine, and the other brain developed over that. And when you do this, you stimulate the limbic brain. And it really helps to cut off rational and logical thinking. It's a great tool for that. Yes?
Another question. I just wanted to say thank you for coming and sharing your practices
with us. It was really a delight to be here. It's really been a wonderful experience, and I really appreciate this. Zendo was very quiet. It was a really beautiful feeling that you all brought. So thank you so much.